Senate Special Committee on Oil and Gas to order. It is Thursday morning, February the 8th, 9:08 a.m. Present Senator Pierce, Chairwoman, Senators Fisher and Kelly. The first item of business this morning will be House Bill 128, Oil and Gas Leases and Royalty Reduction. The sponsor is Representative Kay Brown. We are not on teleconference during the first hour. I hope to deal with this bill before 10 o'clock, at which time we will go on teleconference and continue with Mr. Chenoweth and the administration on Senate Bill 359, the first of the oil spill bills. Welcome, Representative Brown.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate you taking up House Bill 128. Madam Chairman, three of the four provisions in this bill result from suggestions from the Department of Natural Resources to streamline the oil and gas leasing statute. Generally, what we're trying to accomplish is to make the process as efficient and to make it work as well as possible so that we can continue aggressively leasing our potential state lands that have high oil and gas potential and hopefully make up some of the revenue stream when crude oil day declines. I will briefly summarize, Madam Chair, the provisions. Section 1 would lengthen the use of a best interest finding for two types of sales, exempt sales and reoffering sales. I believe the committee has in your background material a chart prepared by the division that's very helpful in understanding. It looks like this. This chart basically shows that there's three types of sales. There are the regular sales, so-called, and those are subject to the five-year schedule, and there are a number of provisions in 3805-180 which govern the terms and conditions and all the things regarding regular sales. Then there's two categories that the statute sets out, recognizing that once a sale has been held and acreage is offered, that some exceptions are made when it's reoffered in the future. Exempt sales are sales which the acreage was previously under lease, the lessee relinquished it, or the lease expired, and it's now come back into the state's portfolio of land. What this bill would do is allow a five-year-old best interest finding to support a reoffering of that acreage. It just lengthens the time from 3 to 5 years. Reoffering sales are sales where you offered it, but there were no bids on it, so it's still in state ownership, and it would have the same effect of lengthening the five-year schedule. I'll briefly skip to Section 3 of the bill, since it also affects reoffering sales. This bill proposes to lengthen the term of a reoffered lease to allow a maximum of a 10-year term instead of a five-year term. The effect of this five-year limitation in the current statute means that that provision for reoffering acreage, reoffered acreage, is not useful. And to my knowledge, the department is not using it, has never used it, because if the people weren't interested in getting it for 10 years, they're not going to be interested in 5 years, and just would make it consistent with the 10 years, which is what we use in all other oil and gas lease sales and have for a number of years. Section 2 of the bill, Madam Chair, involves language relating to royalty reductions. Under the language that's proposed in House Bill 128, there would be two times, under two circumstances, when a royalty reduction would be considered or could be granted by the Commissioner of Natural Resources. The first would be to prolong the life of a field that is nearing the end of its life. When you get to the end of field life, costs go up, and there may be the opportunity by lowering a royalty to keep a old declining field in production for a few more years by reducing those costs. The second type of situation would be to reestablish commercial production for shut-in oil or gas that would otherwise not be economically feasible. Madam Chair, how I came to propose this language relates to a situation that I was very familiar with during the 4 years that I was director from 82 to 86. The Milne Point field was a very small field. The leases had been expiring in the late 70s, I believe it was 1979. At that time, in return for extending those leases, the commissioner renegotiated the royalty to 20%. So here we have the smallest field on the North Slope carrying the highest royalty burden. Before that field went into production, the companies involved made a long, involved effort to get their royalty reduced. We, the department, were precluded from considering their request because current law says you can't consider a request until there's been 2 years of production. So after several years of discussion and denial by the department of a royalty reduction, the companies involved went ahead and started production at Milne Point. They were a few months into production when the 1986 price collapse occurred. They kept going for a while, hoping that conditions would improve. When conditions did not improve, they shut the field in. We were persuaded on the basis of our several years of discussions with them that this truly was a marginal situation. At the time, I believe that they shut in, they had only been in production for 13 months, and they were still not eligible for consideration. I think the language proposed here will give us a more flexible situation and allow us to address the issue of price volatility, which I think we can continue to expect. There's going to be changes going up and down. In order to encourage small marginal projects to come online and to keep them in production, should we have a situation like that in the future, I believe it makes sense to make the modifications that are proposed in House Bill 128. It would further clear up an ambiguity that I noticed and struggled with when I was director, and that appears on lines 5 and 6 of page 3. The fact that you're supposed to consider the revenue from all hydrocarbons, but relating that to an individual lessee's investment. And that's just not, it's just nonsensical. It should be the lessee's share of the hydrocarbons, and that change is proposed. Further, on lines 8 through 16 of page 3, we are proposing to explicitly give the commissioner the authority to attach conditions that would protect the state's interest in the event that you did make a reduction to accommodate a severe price drop. And then when the price came back up, the notion is that the state's interest would be protected by going back to the former royalty if conditions warrant that. And also, what I consider probably one of the more significant provisions of this bill is the direction, the policy direction to the commissioner of what we're trying to achieve. And that is the maximum possible return to the state consistent with a reasonable rate of return for the lessee. So what we're saying by this language is, commissioner, we only want you to give away what's necessary to get the thing going. We don't want you to just reduce it more than is necessary. And right now, the statute is pretty open-ended, and the only real, you know, protection or what's keeping us from giving reductions would be the 2 years production. But beyond that, it doesn't direct the commissioner as to what they should consider or how it should be approached. So I think that is a language that will protect the state's interest and it will allow flexibility to address changing circumstances and hopefully help us promote marginal field development. Finally, Madam Chair, just briefly, Section 4 of the bill regards the public notice requirements of not only the oil and gas leasing program, but virtually everything else that the Department of Natural Resources does. The need for this change results from an amendment to this section of the law that was made by the legislature in 1988. At that time, the House adopted a bill that would have that does now require notice to community councils. When the bill was under consideration in the Senate, the suggestion was made that oil and gas sales should be exempted and should not have to give notice to community councils. In trying to implement that change, the language was placed incorrectly. My understanding is that what was meant was to only exempt the oil and gas and geothermal leasing from the notice to community council section. However, it was placed on lines 3 and 4, as you see on page 4, and had the effect of exempting oil and gas lease sales altogether from the public notice requirement. The department continues to give notice, and I think this is just a cleanup change to reestablish the longstanding requirements for public notice when we lease valuable natural resources. That's a brief summary. I'd like to just briefly comment on the industry's position. The industry has been mostly silent on this bill, which I believe in this context could be taken as a no objection on their part. There is the letter of support from Conoco. My understanding, and you may want to talk further with Director Eason about this, is that they are now less enthusiastic about this bill than they were last year, because I believe they've now passed their 2 years and are eligible for consideration under the current statute. This bill would impose some additional requirements for the showing, as I discussed a moment ago, and that may be what's affecting their position. But regardless of their position or any particular industry comment on it, I feel that it's in the public interest to make these changes, that it will improve our leasing program. I would like to propose, Madam Chair, one minor amendment on page 3, line 5. This was suggested yesterday by staff and by Director Eason, and I concur with this suggestion, and that is, on page 3, line 5, to change the word or to and, so that it would read, the commissioner may not grant a reduction of royalty unless the lessee requesting the reduction makes a clear showing that the revenue from the lessee's share of all hydrocarbons produced from the field is and is likely to continue to be insufficient to produce a reasonable rate of return with respect to the lessee's total investment in the field. Thank you again for taking the time to hear this bill, and I'd be happy to respond to any questions from the committee.
Questions? Senator Fisher.
Yes, thank you, Representative. Have you made any effort to ask the other major producers to give a response, and then they just didn't respond to you, or are you just assuming that if they're interested, they'd be here?
Well, actually, I had a discussion yesterday with a representative from ARCO. He was not aware of the bill. I did have some discussions last year with various representatives, and you know, I haven't said please come and testify on this bill, but they are aware of it, I believe, and
okay.
I don't know why they choose not to come forward and say something.
Well,
but
you know, the committee contacted AOGA, ARCO, BP, Exxon. I just talked to John Ringstead this morning. He's busy getting information about the unfortunate oil spill off the California coast. So the company has a neutral position. They didn't want to testify. ARCO, Beverly Ward, told us yesterday that they don't plan to testify and they are neutral on the bill. Conoco did call and express their new objection because they're now past the 2 years. And AOGA did not send a representative or choose to testify, so I assume they're neutral. And to be honest, I don't remember what Dave Parrish said. I talked to Dave directly, and he didn't indicate that Exxon had any great interest. So,
what's your intention to?
I would like to move it out today, but we have Director Eason here. Yes.
Oh, then it goes resources.
Mm-hmm. $150,000 barrels.
Ouch.
Is that right? 150? No.
I didn't hear the question. I'm sorry, I can't hear the question.
Senator Kelly asked how large the spill is off Huntington Beach that happened. It's a smaller tanker that was lightering crude that actually had the spill. Two of their tanks were breached, they think perhaps by their own anchor, and 125,000 or 150,000.
I just heard the news report on the radio.
Okay, gallons. Yeah. The slick is about 3 miles long and a mile wide. They're hope because there are no winds at the moment, they're hoping it stays offshore. So, but in answer to your question, Senator Fisher, yes, all the companies have been contacted. No one had any proposed amendments, no testimony that they wanted to give.
Thank you.
Representative Brown, I do have... go ahead, Senator Kelly. Pardon? Yes, it's Alaska crew. British Petroleum's, but of course they can't own their ship, so it's not their ship. It's a leased ship. Representative Brown, on section 2, just to clarify your intention, and you were talking about the volatility of oil prices, and should the director and the commissioner decide to do a royalty reduction, can they, and that they have some ability to fashion that so that it just fits the volatility. Would it be your intention that the reduction, say, you can have a reduction of your royalty unless and until oil prices reach such and such a level again, or that sort of a thing? So in other words, it could be a 1 year, a 2 year, it could be based on price.
Yes, that it would, what I had envisioned was some kind of trigger that would, when the price of ANS at a certain defined location exceeded a certain level, that either there would be an automatic return to, or at least a reopening and revisiting of the issue.
Okay, great. Thank you. If you'll stay with us at the table, I'd like to call Mr. Eason forward. And Mr. Eason, along with just your position on the bill, and I know you've worked with Representative Brown on it, could you give us a quick overview of the process that you and your department and your division go through when a company is interested in a royalty reduction? Do you look at, and I guess my interest is, does just one lessee come and ask for a reduction, or do all the owners of a particular field usually trump in together?
I will try to do that. Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jim Eason, and I'm the director of the Division of Oil and Gas. And for the record, the administration does support Representative Brown's bill. In answer first to your question, the state's experience to date with royalty reduction requests has been very limited. And, of course, I think one of the reasons why that's the case is that I believe everyone that has looked at the statute as it exists today, as well as it will exist if it's amended, recognizes that there will be a fairly rigorous accounting of investments over a long period of time, usually, capital investments plus operating expenses plus total revenue generated from total production to date plus a prediction of what production will be in the future and some assessment of what people think the likely price is going to be, so that all those things can be rationalized to try to determine what a company is making at any point in time and then try to assess whether it's likely to make less or more in the future. So I think it's always been assumed that this will be a fairly difficult exercise, a fairly involved exercise to get to an answer, because we feel on the state side that that's expected of us, that we make sure that royalty reductions are appropriate and that the amount of reduction is appropriate to the circumstance. And I think the companies have expected that. And the only direct experience that I'm familiar with, and I believe there are the only two instances to date, with the exception of Conoco, one was a single lessee, Texaco, on behalf of some of its leases in the Cook Inlet, approached the division, I believe, about 6 years ago, perhaps 5 years ago, and suggested that they were going to submit an application for royalty reduction and ask what sort of information we thought would be necessary to support that. And in summary fashion, I pretty much told them what I just told the committee, and they said, thank you, we will come back and tell you what materials we have. And as I recall, a day or so later, they called back and said that they thought that it was too much effort to compile the information to bring it forth to justify the reduction. And so they didn't pursue the matter any further. We currently have an application pending from another Cook Inlet lessee, Marathon, on some oil leases and some oil production in Cook Inlet. And the Marathon has provided a great deal of information, and we are currently evaluating that information to determine just what those investments have been over time, what their earnings have been on those investments, and what the likelihood is that they're going to have that same result in the future. I think we are still several weeks or months from having that analysis concluded, and that, as I said, is the second of three, and the third was Conoco, who has not to date been prepared to submit an application because, as Representative Brown said, the two-year period had not elapsed. That has elapsed, I believe, within the last week or perhaps 2 weeks, and based upon conversations we've had with them over the last probably 3 months, off and on, I fully expect that we'll have an application probably within this month. If it hasn't arrived this week, we'll have it down here.
Okay. Mr. Eason, would the fact that this bill is hopefully moving on the Senate side, and I would hope does make it to the floor, is that going to affect in any way your process that you're presently working on with Marathon or what you envision with Conoco?
No, Madam Chairman, I would not intend for it to. I think that we've had the existing statutes in place, and we've been responsible for trying to administer the programs under that. And of course, as I said, are doing that now with the Marathon application, and I would presume that we would continue that with the Conoco application. I believe that, of course, the kinds of information that we would require, the depth of analysis, and the certainty that we're going to require before we make a recommendation to the commissioner for royalty reduction would essentially be the same. The process, may be different, and of course, under the amendments that are proposed, we would presume that we would adopt regulations and that there would be a fair amount, or I would say a good amount of public involvement, including other companies and the public at large. But I think that we fully expect that what we do in the case of Marathon and Conoco is going to have to make the members of the legislature, the administration, and the public comfortable. And so we're going to be very careful to try to do something that is reasonable, responsible, and makes sense to everyone, and also that's well documented.
Okay, and a couple more questions. At what point, for the record, does the royalty rate become attached to a particular lessee initially? At what point in the process? That come with the initial lease? At what point do they attach themselves to whatever percentage they get?
Typically, the royalty rate is a condition of the lease when it's issued competitively, and there have been, to my knowledge, this is the only instance that I'm aware of where a royalty rate was increased as a condition of unitization, and as Representative Brown mentioned, that occurred when Conoco was had a number of these leases that were very near the expiration date, and had, as I recall, they had drilled one well, confirming that there was a discovery, but found themselves with a number of leases and unable, a number of potentially productive leases, and unable because of the timing, because they had started late to try to develop them, to test and evaluate each of those before they expired. So they came to the commissioner and proposed a unit, and as a condition of that, he required that they renegotiate the royalty rate at that time.
So you virtually have to drill in within each lease, no matter what your underlying field parameters are, to do a unitization, to keep that lease once you hit the, if you're getting close to the 10 years, even if you've drilled here, 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 and here, if you've got a lease in the middle, you've got to go ahead and drill there too?
No, that's not correct. If the leases are not unitized, the obligation is for each lease to either drill or to commence drilling and to continue to pursue drilling in a diligent manner is the standard. And failing that, there are other alternatives. If you have the lease committed to an approved unit and you are operating under an approved plan of exploration and development under that unit, that extends all the leases as long as you continue to meet those standards for the period of the unit.
Do you foresee running into a situation where one owner of a field might ask for a royalty reduction and the others not, or would you expect to see them work in concert?
I fully expect that we will see the former, perhaps the latter, but I would think that the former would be the most likely, because just like those of us around the table, we all have different bank accounts, and the lessees are the same, and in some cases, the equity, of course, their equity is different in each unit, so that the amount of oil they're entitled to and the amount of money that they'll make from that oil is different, and an Exxon, for example, that's receiving 70% of the oil from a unit is a quite differently situated company from a Conoco that perhaps is receiving, has 15% of the oil and 15% of the revenue, but because of its size is required to make a rather hefty investment.
If one more question that leads from that. If a company has made a bad business decision in a unitization agreement for whatever reason, and I assume they don't often do this, but has burdened themselves with more operating costs than they perhaps should have, it wouldn't be the state's responsibility to bail them out of that, would it? I mean, is that the sort of thing you'd be looking for as you...
No, I would hope not. I personally think it would not. The history of this has been discussed many, many times by Conoco and others that were in that unit. There are a number of people that were members of the unit that in the intervening period since 85, since 86 when production was suspended, that have actually sold their interest to Conoco. So over the years, Conoco has become a larger and larger leaseholder in the Milne Point unit, as other people who I suspect were less able to stand a period of suspension as long as that was, and continuing cost with that. As those people were pushed further and further toward an untenable position, they sold their lease interest to Conoco. But Conoco, although it found itself with a 20% royalty rate on some marginally economic leases, it at least had the opportunity to determine what was under those leases,
sure,
at the exclusion of everyone else. The alternative it was facing, since it had not diligently drilled those wells on all those leases until the last year, was that it made a major discovery at that time, and it faced not being able to own all the leases overlying it, and it was a deal. It was something that brought them some benefit, and the commissioner tried to carve some benefit out for the state. we all now can look back with a lot better hindsight than either of those parties had at looking forward and say, well, this deal maybe wasn't as good for Conoco as they thought, or the state got a better deal than it thought. But I believe that everybody tried to carve the best deal for both parties at the time, and we just now know that we have better vision than they did.
You have testimony, but well, go ahead, Senator Fisher.
No, I was just going to ask, you know, your opinion. Why do you think the industry appears to be neutral? I mean, there's got to be some pluses and some minuses. Can you think of a reason why they would not want this bill?
I believe the amendment to the bill is, I believe the standards that I would apply or would recommend that the commissioner apply are going to be very close, if not the same. But the statutes as they exist today, there is not the explicit provision that we can condition a royalty reduction with safeguards to protect the state in the event that not only revenues increase from rising oil prices, but that if operating costs go down and therefore the profit is higher, even though oil prices stay the same. I think that as I approach a royalty reduction request, I would want in a decision to build some safeguards in there today as well as tomorrow or this time next year under the more explicit language, because I believe that the public interest would require that. I don't think that it's a good way to do business to look at a snapshot of the world today with oil prices as they are and with operating costs as they are and try to predict oil prices and sort of factor all that together and sign a check or write a letter, if you will, for a royalty reduction that doesn't provide some kind of safeguard in case we've guessed wrong, we've analyzed it improperly, or tomorrow the world changes drastically. I mean, tomorrow Conoco could find itself in a world where technology has made it possible to drill additional wells at half the price they are today, that oil prices are $3 a barrel higher and likely to stay there. And if there was no provision, I look at it as a continuum. We need to be sure that a royalty reduction makes sense today based on everything that's happened when a lessee comes in. But we also need to provide protection so that if that world changes and it flips completely the other way, that the state doesn't sit forever with no royalty perhaps or 2% royalty or something of that order, while a company is earning 100% return, not 100%, but let's say 50% return on its investment. And that could happen. So it's going to be a difficult balancing act and one that we, I think, have to be very careful to confirm that, first of all, the company needs what it asked the state for, and that the state explains exactly why it believes that's appropriate, how long it thinks it should be appropriate, under what circumstances it might not be appropriate any longer.
Thank you.
Mr. Eason, do you want to speak to any of the particular sections of the bill? And do you support the amendment that Representative Brown proposed?
Yes, Madam Chairman, I do support the amendment that was proposed. I don't think I could contribute anything better than Representative Brown has in her section by section analysis. We think that it is a good bill that would be helpful for us as we do what I think are going to be very difficult tasks of looking at royalty reduction requests. But the fact of life is I believe we're going to have obviously more and more of them as time goes on because the fields that are producing are getting older and it's likely that new fields that are discovered on the North Slope and Cook Inlet are not going to be of the same scale as some of the fields we've seen today. And I think it's an issue that we're going to have to face and I believe that the language that's proposed will be more helpful to us in doing that and trying to structure that.
Mm-hmm. Senator Fisher, do you have any other questions? Okay, does anyone else want to testify on this bill? All right, what we'll do is stand at ease. Senator Halford was in the hallway just a moment ago, and we'll get he and Senator Kelly back in and try to get the bill moved out, and then at 10 o'clock we plan to take up Senate Bill 359. Let's bring the committee back to order. Senator Kelly, would you like to publicly say what you just read on the AP wire?
Madam Chair, the bill in California was 290,000 gallons of Alaska crude oil by BP, and BP has accepted responsibility.
Okay, thank you. Okay, once again, we have before us House Bill 128 by Representative Grant Brown. I need first a motion for an amendment on page 3, line 5, changing the word or to and. Mr. Kelly so moves. Are there any objections? Okay, the amendment has been accepted. And can we have a motion on the bill, please?
Madam Chair, I move the bill out of
Are there any objections? House Bill 128, we will do a Senate CS for House Bill 128, Oil and Gas, with individual recommendations. Thank you very much, Representative Brown. We will have coming both the administration folks. We have why don't we take an at ease until 10 o'clock, which is when we said we'd go back on teleconference with the people from Kodiak to have Mr. Chenoweth finish his sectional analysis and also have the administration give their position on the oil spill bill. Call the Senate Special Committee on Oil and Gas back to order. We have before us sponsor substitute for Senate Bill 359. Because it's got such a long title, it's affectionately known as the Oily Mayor's Oil Spill Bill. We have Mr. Chenoweth with us to continue his discussion of the drafting of the draft for us. We are online on teleconference at the moment. We have only Anchorage online. Eileen Smith in the North Pacific Rim is back with us today. We are hopeful that we will be adding Kodiak and Mr. Matt Jamin online for a discussion of the retroactivity portion, but in his absence, I'm sure Mr. Chenoweth will be happy to speak through that portion of the bill. Mr. Chenoweth, I believe you were going to speak to the first three sections first. Whatever order you want to do is fine.
Let me preface this by saying that Mr. Jamin called before I came over here and said he was in deposition this morning. He was going to try to find a substitute in Anchorage, Ed Harris. Otherwise, we would take the question. Couldn't be answered any further along. Yesterday, we took a look at the two grant programs in the bill, the Impact Assistance Grant, the new grant program in Section 4, and the amendment to the 470, or the existing fund in Sections 19 through 21. We mentioned the source of the money to pay for these, the amendment to the severance tax, the nickel per barrel increment to the severance tax in Bill Sections 5 through 10. And at the very end, I talked briefly about the Title 29 amendments, Sections 1 through 3. I can touch on them again briefly. In Section 1, we give authority to municipalities, particularly cities, to exercise emergency authority outside their boundaries. In Bill Sections 2 and 3, Bill Sections 2 and 3 address the situation with second and third class boroughs, giving them the authority to exercise oil and hazardous substance cleanup responsibilities on a non-area-wide basis where they had not previously adopted the non-area authority by law. These are technical changes to Title 29 that essentially expand the authority of cities and boroughs to cover emergency situations. I want to next jump to Section...
Excuse me just a moment. What have the municipalities and boroughs been doing on an ongoing basis when they had an emergency in their areas or just outside? Have they just not responded, or have they done so without really being covered under Title 29?
I think the latter. They would prefer to respond and not worry about the consequences given a very large emergency. The situation is, at least as far as cities are concerned, analogous to the situation with fire departments being called upon to put out fires outside the city boundary. What is the liability? What is the responsibility of the municipal fire department outside the city's boundaries? The same questions arise in this context. All we're doing in this is proposing that the cities have the authority in the face of an emergency to go outside the municipal boundaries and be responsible to try to get a handle on the cleanup, ditto with the boroughs where they have not previously adopted the authority. Fairly narrowly drawn to probably significant amendments to municipal attorneys and municipal officials. Let's jump to Section 11. Section 11 is where we left off yesterday, right before you had to go to session. Section 11 and the two following sections, Sections 12 and 13, are amendments to AS 4603-822. This is the strict liability section in current law. A22 was substantially overhauled last session following the Exxon Valdez disaster, largely at the behest of the administration. The key to Section 822, you'll see May on page 10 in line 14, phrase that begins, the following persons are strictly liable jointly and severally for damages to persons or property, whether public or private, including damage and so forth and so on. This establishes the standard by which those who allow oil or hazardous substances to be discharged in violation of law may be held civilly liable to various parties for the damages they cause. And what this first
change, Section 11 does, and let's pass over the one that says annual limitation set out in pay of the section for a minute. What this does is expand the scope of liability, if you will, not only to the state and the municipalities, but consistent with what we were talking about yesterday, to village councils. And it expands it further to define the damages as covering the incremental costs of providing public services that are incurred by the state, the municipality, or a village council, resulting from the release of the hazardous substance. So there are two significant expansions there, one as to who may recover, a village council, and another as to what may be recovered, the incremental costs of providing public services. Section 12 makes it...
Senator Fisher.
Before we go on Section 11,
mm-hmm.
who determines what a substantial threat is?
Well,
on line 23, you know, substantial threat of an unpermitted release.
My guess would be that this is a matter for the courts in the determination of whether there shall be liability and the degree of liability and damages to be paid.
Okay.
This is not an administrative determination.
Okay. Madam Chairman, the other one is, if there, in your opinion, we're talking about an unpermitted release, but if there was a permit gotten for release years ago, and even though the law now says it would not be permitted, but the fact that it was permitted when it was legal, we can't make something retroactive, can we, say, in other words, today something may be permitted, some kind of waste discharge, and I get a permit and I go ahead and do it. 5 years down the road, the law changes and it's not permitted to have this anymore, but somebody says, well, there's a threat of an unpermitted release of something going into the ground, but at the time I did it, it was legal. How does that fit in with this?
There are substantial questions in my mind as to the ability to hold someone liable under this provision, where you have once issued a permit for permissible conduct, and then you, the legislature, come around and statutorily eliminate or modify.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, the person has a valid permit out there. There may be some grandfathering rights that attend that permit. It has a valid life for a period of time that the person relies upon. I should think that as long as the person relied upon a valid permit, even if the law changes subsequently to the issuance of that permit, there's a real serious question about the person's liability. The permit was valid when issued, it had a life of its under which it could be operated under. The legislature has stepped in and changed the law, but those valid permits still must be honored. I don't think that you're going to have a very successful claim after the fact under this particular.
Mr. Chambers, I have a question. Does this Section 11 stands alone without there having to be a declaration of an emergency disaster? Is that correct?
It goes to unpermitted release of a hazardous substance. It is not qualified in terms of magnitude, as I recall. I'd have to dig into the statute, but I don't think it is. This is a section that stands without regard to volume discharge.
And while the portion of the wording that I'm thinking about it isn't new language in the statute, but looking at lines 22 through 24 and thinking about the recent experience in Cook Inlet with Mount Redoubt, had, say, the city of Homer decided that there was a substantial enough risk from the Drift River Terminal that it might spill oil because of the volcano, and they had gone ahead and protected, but with booming or whatever that they put up, whatever in Homer, be it the harbor, be it the try to protect the host bay, one of the hatcheries, anything. Could they, under lines 22 through 24, because they believed that there was a substantial threat, come back and consider the owners of Drift River liable for those costs and attempt to recover?
If it's a strict liability statute, you would have had a case that said City of Homer versus where the owners of Drift River are. The court would have to agree with the City of Homer that their decision to obtain and deploy boom around the harbor or whatever else they went through was reasonable given the circumstances, the information that they had on which to base their decision.
Okay.
If Homer could carry the burden of showing that there was a substantial threat, recovery might be allowed under 822.
Senator Fisher.
But in any case, just to say Homer decides to do something,
do you make the assumption it'll go to court? I mean, the money's going to be coming out of this fund, right? Somebody's going to authorize...
This is a strict liability section. Homer could recover for damages to persons or property based upon its reading of a substantial threat of an uncommitted release. And let's say they incurred $100,000 worth of expenses, actual expenses, damages, if you will, to the city's treasury in deploying and obtaining and deploying boom around the harbor. And nothing happened. Drift River continued to function. Homer said, well, we're out $100,000. What are we going to do here? If they could make the case for the reasonableness of their activity in obtaining and deploying that boom in the face of what they saw happening across the inlet, a court might agree with you. This is a recovery from the person having responsibility for the hazardous substance.
Okay.
No, this section is not a grant supporting provision.
Oh, then Homer doesn't come to the state and say, we want out of that fund $100,000, and they get it, and then somebody's got to say, well, we don't think you should have it.
Not under 822.
Okay.
Now, this section stands alone from the new fund.
822A, the amendments to 822A opened up the possibility of recovery by a village council, and they tried to narrow or focus on what could be recovered. That is, the incremental costs of providing public services that are incurred by the state and municipality or village council. Who may recover and what may be recovered for?
And the damages, Madam Chairman, are strictly physical damages, not mental health type damages.
Damages are what you can prove they are, and it's an interesting question as to whether damages would include, for example, municipal expenditures from the Treasury, taking our example, to acquire boom and to deploy it around a harbor in the face of what was happening across the inlet. Was the city damaged? I don't know. I think that there's room there for them to argue.
Let me look at a different case, if I could. I'm talking in the case, say, a village council, and they also have a nonprofit mental health group, and they say, my God, the threat of something happened, because we're talking the threat of an unpermitted release, caused a lot of mental anguish, and therefore they had to do a lot of mental health type things. Is that still covered? They could come in and under that basis?
It is possible for them to bring the case. They need to prove the reasonableness of their perceptions or anticipation that they would be damaged and the reasonableness of their response.
Okay. So in any event, it's going to end up a court making a decision.
822 is a judicial matter for the judiciary. 822H on section 12 on the next page, beginning of line 20, makes the same kind of collateral change, picking up references to village councils.
Mr. Chenoweth, are we adding village councils because I know that in the Exxon Valdez bill, some of those village council requests were funneled through the boroughs, in the case of Kodiak and Yek. Are we adding it so they can directly deal with CNRA?
In 822, we are adding village councils as entities who may stand before the court and try to recover.
Okay.
Elsewhere in the bill, we add village councils as potential recipients of grant funds and so forth. But in this particular case, we're giving status to litigate. Show damages. In Section 12 in H, the current law provides a non-liability section that extends to the state and municipality. See it there. Protection against the state or the municipality having protection against litigation against them for their responsive actions. Given that we have incorporated village councils above, we have incorporated village councils here. That is, we've spread the umbrella of protection over village councils by the amendment made in H. 822K, beginning at the bottom of page 11, tries to address the situation where a municipality or village council not only recovers from one of the grant funds, but also seeks to recover under 822A in front of the court. And this we've kind of tagged the no double dipping provision. That is to say that we try to put in language here that says that neither a municipality or a village council may recover from both sources. If you've got a situation, let's go back to the hypothetical of an expenditure for boom and the deployment of boom around a harbor, and we can take the Homer situation, for example. If Homer reasonably believes that it's going to face a hazardous substance discharge, whether from Drift River or whatever, and they convince the commissioner of that and recover a grant. You either get a grant, or if you don't get a grant, and you have actual damages that you spend money for, for example. You can try to recover under 822, but you can't have it both ways. You're not doing Connecticut. You, municipality or village council, ought not to be made more than whole. In 46, section 822, the three preceding sections are part of AS 4603. We introduced two terms, public services and village council, that are not there now. We define those terms in section 14. With section 15, we switch to another chapter in the law. This is AS 4604, the oil control chapter in the law of environmental conservation. Section 15 amends AS 4604.020 by saying that environmental conservation may, in addition to the entities that you see there in the current law, enter into memoranda of understanding or cooperative agreements with municipalities and village councils as it relates to review of oil discharge contingency plans, notification procedures, cleanup procedures, and all the rest. All we're doing is giving status to municipalities and village councils to be parties with the department to these agreements. Current law allows them to enter into agreements with the existing federal entities named there. The oil mayors felt that the same kind of authority should recognize the responsibility to enter into agreements with municipalities and village councils. Section 16 in the same chapter, AS 4604, adds municipal officials and the public as entities or groups that ought to have a crack at commenting upon proposed oil discharge contingency plans before they're approved by the Commissioner of Environmental Conservation. Section 17 is a definition. Now, oftentimes people think, well, definitions really don't carry that much that we should be concerned about. But here, and the other definitions that follow, where the words containment and cleanup are defined, I want to call your attention to the long amendment, the long insertion. First of all, containment and cleanup picks up a reference to discharged oil. AS 4604 is the oil control chapter in Title 46. Unfortunately, it does not incorporate a reference to discharged oil. The mayor is bound and asked that it be added in, and the inclusion makes sense. Lines 12 through 16.
Isn't discharged oil a pollutant?
Pardon me?
Isn't discharged oil a pollutant? Why would we?
You and I would think it might be, but some attorney thought, well, it's arguable, so let's clear up the ambiguity.
If we put discharged oil in by virtue of leaving out some other known pollutants, even though we have AM pollutant, are we therefore setting up a situation where some attorney somewhere is going to say, well, they didn't specifically say that?
Perhaps, but I think this is the chapter that carries the definition of pollutant. We do not in 4604 define the term pollutant, but I can see. So it may be a matter that we should give a little attention to, because of the word pollutant. The longer amendment, standing by itself, probably doesn't make much sense. It says, convenient the term. When applied to expenses, the term includes incremental costs of providing public services incurred in response to an actual discharge of oil or a pollutant, and the costs of providing additional public services incurred in response to the actual discharge of the oil or pollutant. The same variant occurs later on. What makes this significant is that elsewhere in this chapter, in fact, elsewhere in the chapter outside of this bill, current AS 4604.080B allows the Department of Environmental Conservation, requires the department to promptly seek reimbursement of oil discharge cleanup or containment expenses incurred as a result of an actual or imminent catastrophic oil discharge under 2623050. If there's a big catastrophic oil discharge, if a catastrophic oil discharge is imminent, the department shall promptly seek reimbursement of cleanup and containment expenses. But what are those expenses? Those expenses have suddenly gotten larger by virtue of the amendment made in this definition. This definition enlarges that definition to pick up incremental costs of providing public services incurred in response to an actual discharge by states, state agencies, municipalities, and village councils. So the recovery is broadened by virtue of the amendment made in this section.
And just to refresh all of our memories, would you define the incremental expenses again, please?
Well, we've tried not to lay out something definitive. I think it's going to be whatever the agencies represent to, in this case, the Commission of Environmental Conservation. Surely, if they're able to show baseline data, as former Mayor Valdez showed yesterday, in various categories of public service or function, police costs over a period of years average this and then suddenly double. Fire protection costs over a period of years average such and such, suddenly double. Those kinds of the doubling, if you will, represents, in my judgment, the kind of incremental costs of providing existing public services that fits within the definition of this offered in this clause.
But
Senator Szymanski, we're on teleconference, sir.
It would only be recoverable if, but in this case, let's say Exxon had paid for it, they wouldn't be able to go back and go for the incremental increase.
That's,
I mean, there's no double hit. We've got that covered so that they can't go back and double dip.
That's correct. If Exxon had not taken the cost of the patent, it would be out there, and as it is now, I'm sure, facing lawsuits under 822. But it has provided assistance to Valdez and various other municipalities and village councils. And consequently, I'm sure, when all is said and done, the court would look at that and say, all right, you may be liable, but you've already upfronted some of these costs incurred by these municipalities. So we'll not hold you liable again. You have a liability that reaches so much. If you paid in advance, you've advanced to the municipalities and village councils so much. Consequently, subtraction or mathematics, we're going to figure out what exposure is going to mean. Again, in section 17, in section 15, we inserted the term village councils. In section 17, we picked up the term public service. Those terms in section 18 are defined for purposes of the chapter.
Senator Fisher?
Just a question. When we talk about on line 20, service provided by the state, we assume it's directly state. What about a nonprofit that's totally funded by the state? Is that an extension of the state under this?
I think that's arguable. I guess I would be more comfortable arguing the negative side of that. State to me means provided directly or by contract by an agency of the state, or some entity of the state. Now you've got all sorts of arrangements that over the years have been entered into, grants, contracts, and everything else, and I think those are going to have to be handled on a case-by-case basis to determine whether the entity that you're talking about somehow is tied to the state to provide a service or whether it's an independent contract. Section 19 moves us then to the next chapter of AS 46 that we're concerned of. This is the chapter that covers oil and hazardous substance releases. AS 460840 is the existing fund, which ought to be capitalized at $50 million if all the good work of the legislature last year goes as it should. In section 19, the first amendment at lines 17 to 19 adds as a prospective cost, which can be paid for out of this fund, social and economic assessments. We didn't quite use that term, but that's what this is all about. There was some debate as to whether bearing the cost of a social and economic assessment should come under this fund, the existing fund, or should come out of the Title 29 fund proposed earlier in the bill, the Municipal Impact Fund. And I think, at least to this point in time, folks seem more comfortable in leaving it here simply because the effects that are to be evaluated are in response to the release or threatened release. And one of the clear distinctions, although it may not be clear as you wade your way through this, one of the clear distinctions we tried to draw on this is to leave environmental-related kinds of things and first response kinds of things in the existing fund. And to set up 29, the fund in 29, as aimed at providing assistance to municipalities and village councils for functions and services. Despite its name, this seems to tie more rationally into reaction to or response to the release, and seem more logically that it ought to remain on this side of that line.
Mr. Chenoweth, in drafting this, was it your intent that these be assessments after the fact? The way I read it, one could come in and use money from the fund to assess the possible social and economic effects of an upcoming, or a possible release because of the way threatened release is worded in there. And I don't quite know how you would, I can see it becoming part of contingency
planning. My sense is that there should be some imminence to the threatened release. Senator Fisher's example earlier about the city of Homer and the hypothetical we developed of Homer concerned about the Drift River situation in response to an exploding volcano 20 miles behind that facility suggests to me that there is some imminence to that. But if it's just an academic planning exercise in the nature of disaster planning, what if an earthquake strikes, what if there's another oil spill, that kind of thing, that's a little bit more remote.
This, Madam Chairman.
Senator Smansky.
Thank you. And also anticipated under threat and release is there was some discussion, at least some discussion I had related to that, was the case of the Exxon Valdez, where we never anticipated it to ever get out of Prince William Sound. And weeks later, we found the major impact to be in Kodiak. That's the type of thing where potentially you could look at threat and release to extend to that degree if they start thinking down the road, even though Kodiak hadn't been initially hadn't been oiled, looking down the road toward it. You can look at the potential release. That's one of the things that I was looking at, was there a threat and release was made that we Kodiak could come underneath the purpose of the fund and underneath that section and come in and ask for assistance to look at the socioeconomic effects down the road. It could be another way. Let's say the Trans-Alaska pipeline ruptures in the Yukon River and everybody thinks you're going to stop it at one village area and it ends up heading off all the way to Bethel. I don't know where it ends up in Bethel, but...
Now you're confused.
It'd be a threat and release.
That the minute there's a spill from the... If we were redoing the Exxon Valdez...
The commissioner could have made...
As soon as there was a spill from the Exxon Valdez within Prince William Sound, they could have begun an assessment of what the social and economic impacts would be
if they could have
got to Kodiak.
They could have...
We didn't expect it to get to Kodiak.
They could have looked at, it isn't that they didn't expect it. I mean, everybody believed the oil companies were never going to let it get out of Prince William Sound. Next thing you know, nobody believed it was going to get past the end of Kenai Peninsula. Once they recognized that the tides are taking it to Kodiak, they could have done the assessment as to whether or not police officers, hospitals, other public utilities, and other social services would have been needed. That's the only thing I was adding.
Right, you're saying once they realized it was going to
Once they recognized that it was there and it was a potential threatening.
Senator Fisher.
When we talk about threat and release, we're talking only man-made, man-responsible, right? So a volcano wouldn't come in.
Okay. Yes, a volcano would not come in.
Okay, now let's go to the Drift River, which is man-made. Here you have the situation on the floodplain, so there could be imminent danger. Now, I guess what I can't, in my mind, think, the city of Homer probably would have a valid claim. The Nilchik Village Council would. Fort Graham Village Council, English Bay Village Council. I mean, where do you draw the line as to who is responsible for the social and economic effects? Does each little segment, each municipality, can they all go through the same plan? And therefore, you have 20 plans out there, none of them coordinated, each one doing their own thing.
There is that potential. I would suspect that the administrator of the fund, the Commissioner of Environmental Conservation, would be sensitive to the fact that there are villages scattered up and down the east coast, east shore of the Cook Inlet, and that this thing ought not to be replicated 8 or 10 times over, that perhaps there's a function that the borough should take on here. There's a serious likelihood that the readout will cause some problems at the facility and that oil will wind up on the east shore or the west shore. there is a fair degree of discretion in all of this with the Commissioner of Conservation.
But we do need to make sure we don't have apples and pears in the discussion here. This section is under the existing fund that already exists, and the commissioner has the control of that. We're not talking here about grants to communities for doing these.
No, but Madam Chairman, we are talking about.
We're talking about the department making the determination that they will do the assessment.
Okay, I guess what I'm reading is the new language here, which we're talking about the social and economic effects of the release, and this is new.
Right.
And I guess that's what I'm looking at, that this is new language that affects the fund. And if you have 20 entities in Cook Inlet all doing their own social and economic effects without somehow at least indicating, hey, bring them all together, because the borough can't force a municipality to say, well, we're going to do it, and therefore, Homer, you can't do your own, because they may not be satisfied with what they're looking for as far as the social and economic effects. The village council, the borough can't tell the borough government can't tell the village council that, well, we're the borough, and therefore you're in our borough, and you're going to live with this. They're going to say, oh, no, we want to do our own social and economic, you know, impact. And the reason I get concerned about that is when I look at the grant requests to DCRA, I mean, some of them are pretty far-fetched. And if you have everybody going for their own social and economic effects and then no upper limit on how much they can spend, my God, they'll have people going all over the place. So there should be somewhere in here, I don't care if it's a little thing saying hopefully they'll get together or something, but this thing could be really, that in itself could run into millions. And
Mr.
I don't know how you can.
Well, we try to protect ourselves against that situation. We did not say that these assessments would be put in the grant provisions later on in 072, beginning on the next page.
Right.
They sit here in paragraph 1, under a paragraph that says that it is the commissioner who may investigate and evaluate, et cetera, such as monitoring and assessing. And in making an assessment under this paragraph, he may include an assessment of the social and economic effects of the release or threatened release. That puts it squarely at his feet. There's no grant money being handed out here. I think the commissioner has the latitude to contract this thing out. I would think that the commission would be wise enough to, rather than, as I say, replicate this thing 6, 8, 10 times over, that he'd look for some common entity, in the example you gave, the Kenai Peninsula Borough, to help him fulfill this obligation or meet this requirement. But that your concern, your worry, was precisely the reason that this thing didn't show up as an object of a grant, an object for which a grant may be applied for either under the Title 29 fund or under Section 072, beginning on the next page. This we try to keep in-house.
Mr. Chairman, can the, under the statute, can the commissioner delegate this authority?
Within his own department, certainly.
That's what I mean. Okay. Other questions on that section?
Other changes elsewhere in the current law, at the very bottom of the page, purpose of the fund, the commissioner may use money from the fund to recover the cost of the state, a municipality, and again, we add in the village council. All along, we have expanded this into the village council. Why not commit the commissioner to use money from the fund to make these, to recover these costs? Over on the next page at line 11, we add in the grant provision. We went through this yesterday. Paragraph 7 there on line 11, and the next two following sections all deal with the issue of grants to municipalities for emergency first response cleanup. It's environmental-oriented, environment protection-oriented rather than municipal services and functions-oriented. In sections 22 to 23, we throw in the necessary definitions. Again, in section 22, I caution that the long addition there, beginning on page 17, lines 8 through 11, standing by itself probably doesn't make much impact, but there is a provision in an existing law not picked up in this bill. In AS 4608070, the commissioner shall seek reimbursement promptly under this section, AS 4603760E, or federal law, for the cost incurred in the cleanup or containment of oil or hazardous substance that has been released. Given that he is required to seek reimbursement under this section, reimbursement sought is expanded here to pick up the possibility of reimbursement for incremental costs associated with what the state has incurred in the way of incremental services. Almost done. 4609 is a chapter in the title that deals with hazardous substance release control. The amendment made in section 24 on the last page, requested by the mayor's this is a section that, from my point of view in handling municipal drafting is badly located. Nevertheless, in the law, and it says municipalities can do whatever is necessary to help in responding to a release or threatening release or to exercise powers necessary to implement this chapter, AS 4609, and existing AS 4608. Omitted from that is any reference to AS 4604, which, as I said earlier, is the crime oil control chapter. The mayor's asked that that reference go in, and we put it in. The long amendment in section 25, I would say no more than what I said before, where that language occurs in the definition of detainment and cleanup, because somewhere in the law, in this case, the section I just read to you there, 4608070, permits the commissioner to go out and, or directs him to go out and recover damages, and this is there, it expands the recovery of damages. The definition of public services is provider. I don't want to overlook one thing on the previous page on 17, that old clause of all incidental administrative costs shows up on lines 11 and 12 on page 17. Someone had a question about that yesterday, but came and tried to, it sleeps there too. I was asked yesterday, and I will make way for someone else, I was asked yesterday, well, why did you develop this with two funds? And as I said at the start of my testimony yesterday, we started this with one fund. We started this by increasing the existing fund from $50 to $75 million. That was the approach that we took. And I, after drafting that, became convinced that that probably wasn't as useful as it should be for two reasons. First, it does not admit for any role for community and regional affairs, or the Commission of Community and Regional Affairs, and the people on the staff of that department. Those are the folks who have the best perspective on an ongoing basis as to what municipalities are up to. They've looked at budgets, they have their contacts with municipal mayors, councils, assemblies, managers, and so forth, and are in a better position to say, all right, what's the baseline of what a municipality's been doing so far, and what are the incremental costs? It seemed wiser then to find a role for community and regional affairs insofar as we're talking about what to do with $25 million of additional assistance for municipal government, for municipal functions and services. Secondly, it seemed to me to make more sense not to have municipalities and state agencies at each other's throats in the Office of the Commissioner of Environmental Conservation over what to do with $75 million. They would have all been competing for the same pot. And it seemed to me that the Commissioner of Environmental Conservation, when he's concerned about an environmental threat, actual or imminent, ought to be concerned about that and how it's going to be cleaned up. He didn't need to have to worry about squabbling with local governments over how to divvy up the fund between claims for municipal services and functions versus what are legitimate costs involved with first response cleanup or ongoing cleanup as we've experienced in the Exxon Valdez situation. So my thought was to recommend the sponsor, and he agreed, to divide the funds, and we have done that. Funds, accounts, you can call them what you want, you can put them back together. Those are the reasons that I offered the sponsor and suggestion that we proceed along parallel.
Thank you. Senator Fisher.
Question generally as to how it's handled. When money is spent for equipment, items that have value, by a municipality, by the state, the Department of Environmental Conservation, what happens to those assets when they're sold? I guess what I'm saying is there could be $2 million worth of things bought for an emergency. The emergency's over, and now the municipality says, well, gosh, we got this stuff, so they sell it. And then they put that money in their general treasury. Shouldn't it come back somehow to the fund? Or
that's a policy call. But you're right.
I'm concerned about that because I know the federal government, when I was in the school business, we had to commit to so many years when we got free things. You had to commit to so many years you couldn't sell it. And I can see a tremendous opportunity here. Well, I shouldn't say an opportunity, but a possibility where you can convert these things into operating dollars for the budget that have nothing to do with the spill at all. And I think we maybe need to look and make sure that these kind of things can happen.
Well, I think the sponsor was sensitive enough to the issue as far as real estate and improvements. We tried to write that out. We tried to downplay that very much. But you're right. There are things in the way of equipment that police departments, fire departments, health clinics, road divisions or departments in a municipal government are going to point to and say, we need these in response to a hazardous substance emergency. And they're probably valid, they're probably right, and they're given the go-ahead to buy them from grant funds, or they buy them anyway and they try to recover the money under the strict liability provision. Time passes and those things no longer have they probably still can be used, but they don't have the immediate need that they did when they were first acquired in response to the oil situation, to have this septic situation. In the meantime, off California, there's another disaster, and somebody down there says, well, they've got all this extra whatever it is up in Kenai or Juneau or what have you. Let's offer it. It's there. It's close. We can get it down here overnight on a good-sized airplane. Let's offer to buy it. And the municipality says, sold. You're right. I mean, it could happen. It could happen. My experience with pipeline impact 15 years ago was that municipalities tried to run past the Department of Community and Regional Affairs, all sorts of things, but they had a life of their own that went beyond the hump of pipeline impact activity. And that isn't what the legislature was interested in funding at all. But there were some kinds of equipment, capital expenditures, as you would understand them in the budget process, that they got their hands on, and they're probably still using they got their hands on them under the heading of pipeline impact, and I suppose we go back and find out what they were, and some of these municipalities are probably still using them. It's going to be hard to draw that line with any kind of distinction. If you want me to, I can go back into the federal law that you mentioned as an example and try to pull something.
See, they use that for surplus property type thing, and I'm just, I don't know, maybe it's something that after a certain period of time, the municipality has to give some kind of an update what they did with it or something, but I guess I'm concerned with all the computers that we bought for DEC during this crisis in Valdez. I'm not talking about that now. But I can know what's going to happen to those. I understand now we can't find some of them. And there's got to be better control, because I see when you start talking a pot of money like this, you're not really in competition. I don't envision, in all due respect to Senator Szymanski, this pot to ever be 75 million. It's going to be used as it comes in. That's just my feeling. So I'm not excited over going from 50 to 75, because I don't think we'll ever see 50. It'll be spent before it ever gets to 50, and we'll just continuously use it. But if you could check into it, I guess I'm a little bit concerned that we don't open the door, because now we're not only talking the state, we're talking municipalities, village councils, the whole works. And it's got to be a legitimate item, and assuming it is a legitimate item, it should be used for that. Or if it's used for the benefit of that grantee or grantee, somehow maybe that money should come back to the state and not stay in that community, or to the pot of money that it came from.
Thank you, Senator Fisher. It's 10:45. We're doing the floor at 11. We have had joining us on teleconference are Everett Harris, the attorney for the city of Cordova, who I understand is in Anchorage. We also have Kodiak online, although I'm not sure who's there. And what I'd like to do at this time is bring Mr. Plasman, and I don't know whether it's going to be Amy Kyle or Gail or both of you from DEC, but why don't we bring the two administrative agencies to the table together. You have in your packets a position paper from Community and Regional Affairs. So in the interest of time, since we have that, I think we'll let Kyle, it looks like, give the DEC testimony on the bill first, and then as time is appropriate, we'll have Mr. Plasman talk fast. It's my intent Tuesday morning, and I think we are noticed for 8 or 8:30. We are noticed for 8 o'clock next Tuesday morning, assuming we can get the senators assembled together at 8 a.m. It's my intention to have our staff attorney, David Rogers, work with Senator Szymanski's office, with the offices of some of the senators on the committee who have expressed concerns about various portions of the bill, the two departments and Mr. Chenoweth, to try to have a CS prepared for Tuesday morning. I would like, we will try to have that ready on Monday for the interest of the, I know the committee wants to testify, and also, where did he go? Mr., we lost him, the environmental lobby person gave up on his bill. At any rate, I would hope to take their testimony Tuesday morning on the CS. We will have that ready, hopefully on Monday. If not, we won't. We will make time available for you to testify when you have a chance to see it. So with that, Amy, welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chairman, my understanding is that the committee had requested that we provide information about expenditures to date from the 470 fund, and that was what you wished to hear from DEC on at this time. Is that still correct, or is that no longer?
Well, we have the status report in our
files, the senator who had specifically requested that information is not at the table at the moment, so what I'd rather do now is get an actual position on the bill, get this information to him, and see if there are any further questioning from him.
Madam Chairman, in that case, I would suggest that perhaps Mr. Plasman should speak first, and
okay.
He's the lead presenter for the administration
okay.
on this bill, that, with your concurrence.
Okay, that is fine. Mr. Plasman, you don't have to talk quite so fast.
The chair
being. She has a position. I think she should go.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jim Plasman. I'm Deputy Director for the Municipal and Regional Assistance Division for the Department of Community and Regional Affairs, and it's my pleasure to have the opportunity to address your committee on this bill. The administration has had an opportunity to review the bill, and at least in some of the broadest aspects, to establish a position on particularly the funding mechanism set out in the bill. The administration certainly recognizes and supports the need for a mechanism to address municipal, social, and economic needs resulting from catastrophic release of oil or hazardous substances into the environment. However, the administration, it is the feeling of the administration that it's not necessary or desirable to create a separate fund in the manner approached in this bill, but rather that the existing oil and hazardous substance release response fund be amended to provide access to the funds in that fund for municipal these municipal social and economic needs. The administration would support tapping to that fund up to 10% of the balance of the fund, or up to $5 million. The administration, however, does not at this point see the need to raise the cap from $50 million to $75 million as proposed in the legislation. I think that the Department of Environmental Conservation in particular has some further technical comments on the bill that I believe they'll be willing to present either in oral testimony at this time or in a letter to the committee later today or tomorrow.
Thank you, Mr. Plasman. Is CNRA, is the commissioner comfortable with accepting the responsibility for handling these grants, and do you feel that your department is the proper place for that responsibility?
Yes, Madam Chair, I think that it is appropriate for those municipal, social, and economic impacts to be addressed through Department of Community and Regional Affairs. That certainly was the function played in this last oil spill disaster. There was money, of course, made available for those municipal, social, and economic impacts through our department. I think that probably the Department of Environmental Conservation does not feel that its main area of expertise is in the determination and assessment of municipal, social, and economic impacts, and would be just as happy to have our department deal with those aspects.
Okay, and on pages 3 and 4 of the sponsor substitute, do you have any comments on including incidental administrative costs under whatever fund we're talking about, but under these community costs? And do you have any comments on any of the 8 laid out types of needs that the fund would relate to?
Madam Chair, I think those that it's at least the department's position that those are legitimate concerns and municipal needs. Certainly, in our review of applications that came in the past round of grant applications, we saw a real range of municipal needs. A couple of them were commented on here at the airport carpeting, for instance, or heritage celebrations. Those, of course, were not funded through the process, but often if we get into a situation of specifically naming specific impacts, we sometimes are at danger of eliminating some that just we weren't able to think about at the time. So I think that the list here is pretty comprehensive and would address most of the needs that would come forward.
And does the department have any feeling one way or another about including capital costs. I know that there has been an effort in drafting this bill to not include capital costs.
Madam Chair, I think that Senator Fisher has pointed out some of the concerns that, do accompany the funding of capital costs. I think, however, we have seen in the applications that came before us situations where, for instance, a community, because of the increased population associated with cleanup, would have like a solid waste disposal dump filled up at a rate faster than anticipated, and consequently requested funding for a new dump. And I think that at least the incremental cost that was associated with that increased population demand would be a legitimate concern, and something that could be addressed through such a grant fund.
Any specific questions for Mr. Plasman? Okay. Ms. Kyle?
Madam Chairman, I'll be brief. I know your time is short. For the record, my name is Amy Kyle, and I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Environmental Conservation. I would just say that we support the comments that Mr. Plasman gave. The issues that we're concerned about are to ensure that the level of funding provided for municipal expenses, the social and economic expenses, is proportionately the right amount vis-a-vis the spill response expenses. In other words, we have to set the proper balance between how much money that we allocate for the actual spill response versus how much money we allocate for these secondary impacts, and we feel that the 10% ratio is the appropriate ratio for that. The second concern that we would have is to ensure that there are appropriate controls placed on the expenditures of these dollars, especially given that we're going to be asked to then try to go back and recover them through litigation. And that's something that will require attention as this process is implemented. And I just draw it to your attention as a concern that we have. We will be providing some specific comments on the language in the bill that changes the authority for spill response for municipalities from agreements to grants. That's a second aspect of this bill, and we'll be working with the staff on the language for that this weekend to address the controls issue. A third concern that we would have is that the aspects of the bill that deal with extraterritorial exercise of authorities, it seems to us, should be coordinated with an overall planning process so that each municipality is appropriately exercising its extraterritorial powers. We don't object to what's in the bill, but it would seem to us that the definition of who gets what turf outside municipal boundaries should be part of the overall regional and statewide contingency plan process so that we don't have competing demands on who's responding where from different municipalities. Again, it's not that we have a problem with what's proposed here, but we would like to see that tied into the overall planning process. So very briefly, those are our general comments. We support DCRA as the lead agency to make the determinations about local requests for social and economic assistance. We don't feel that that's an appropriate role for our agency to play. And so we support having that clearly administered by DCRA. And as I say, we do support the position that Mr. Plasma stated in terms of the level of funding to be devoted to that aspect of response. Thank you. Senator Fisher.
Jamie, what I hear you saying is whatever money becomes available, 10% of that amount they can draw down. But we're talking also threats of a potential danger. We're not just talking about this bill. So conceivably, let's assume you have, I don't know, $20 million and 10% is $2 million. Conceivably, what happens, because we're now talking threats, and the community say, we got to do a social impact, and that's going to, and they come to $3 million. Are you saying they're cut off at 2, or can they go to 3, even though it goes over to 10%? But I can see when you start talking about threats, a lot of people consider it a potential threat out that way, and then they kick in using their funds to do the assessments and the economic impact that may happen if this thing, like over Drift River. How does that tie in? They limited them just to 10% of what's in the kitty at the time, or can they, as you see it, just draw down what they really need to have the job done?
Madam Chairman, as in the comments that the administration is proposing, we would limit that to 10% on the theory that that's an appropriate share of the balance to be used for the social and economic aspects. If there is really a real threat, there are going to be other aspects to the response in terms of preparing to deal with the spill that could occur. And I think what we're saying is that there are a whole range of things that need to be done, more in a real spill event, but also in a threatened spill event. A lot of those have to do with actual response, and our concern is that we not unduly diminish our ability to provide an actual response in order to deal with the secondary impacts. We support dealing with the secondary impacts, but we need to set the right balance between those competing needs. And under the proposal that Mr. Plasman is advancing, which is the administration's view, yes, it would be capped at 10% of whatever the balance is at the fund at any particular time, simply so that we did not exhaust the fund on the socioeconomic aspects and then impair our ability to do all the other things that that fund was intended for.
And there would be enough flexibility, I would assume, if the fund does grow to $30 million. It would seem ridiculous to say, well, you have 10% and we've got to retain this. You know, I mean, I think it's workable, isn't it? They could end up, they get 20%. You're not locked into 10, right, by this. This is just an agreement you would have among yourselves, right?
Well, Madam Chairman, in the current draft of the bill, it doesn't speak to this issue. Our recommendation is that we set a share of the available funds to be used for this purpose that is reasonable and that fairly represents the amount of funding that should be spent on that aspect of the response. And our recommendation is that that number should be 10% of what's available.
And the last one, maybe, but how do you see this working, that if, say, there is a response by a municipality, village council or something, and they come to you and say, yeah, we're going to actually, this is a primary, we're going to clean it up, and you say, fine, you can go buy a $50,000 boat. How do you track the boat year two, year three? Do you just fund the boat and walk away, or do you have some kind of mechanism to keep track of that piece of equipment since it's a major piece of equipment?
Madam Chairman, that is a good question. We have not had to deal with that prior to the Exxon spill, and we are reviewing disposition of property for everything that was acquired during the Exxon spill, both state property and municipal property, and it is an issue that needs to be addressed. I wouldn't say we have the answer for you, but we know that we need to deal with that very question, and we simply haven't done it yet. As we define the scope of the work to be done this spring and summer, then we can assess what we have in the way of leftover or surplus property from this spill response, and then we'll make some decisions about what the disposition of that should be. But it's certainly true that at this point we don't have a particular control in place vis-a-vis municipal acquisition of equipment. Mm-hmm. We have not set that in place yet, and that is something we need to attend to.
If I may,
Mr. Plasman.
Madam Chair, Senator Fisher, in our experience dealing with municipal grant programs, if there is a problem with the use of that property after the acquisition of it, that is something that's typically covered in the grant agreement with the grant recipient, so that in the grant agreement it would say either this piece of equipment would be used for X number of years, or if it's sold prior to that time, in the grant agreement itself, provision could be made for the funds to be returned to the state, or the grantee would be liable for that the amount of funding that was granted.
But I think that's a good approach, but the only question I would go is one step further. If it does revert to the state, does it revert back to this fund or does it revert to the general fund?
Madam Chair, typically, Senator Fisher, through in the structure that is typical now, it would go to the general fund unless specifically stated otherwise in statute.
Thank you all very much. We will meet again at 8 a.m. Tuesday morning, and we are adjourned.